welcome to this Touch podcast activity, which has been recorded for Touch Immunology. This podcast provides an update on achieving best practice in the management of primary biliary cholangitis now and in the future. Two experts on autoimmune liver disease, Professor Gideon Hirschfield and Dr. Palak Trivedi, discuss current best practice for the treatment of primary biliary cholangitis, the evolving therapeutic landscape of the disease, and processes for personalising its treatment and management. The discussion is stimulated by questions posed by healthcare professionals involved in the management of primary biliary cholangitis. Financial support for this medical educational activity has been provided to Touch IME by an educational grant from Ipsen Biopharmaceuticals.
Hello and welcome. My name is Dr. Palak Trivedi, and I'm an academic hepatologist and clinician scientist at the University of Birmingham and University Hospitals Birmingham here in the United Kingdom. And I'm joined today by my colleague, Professor Hirschfield, who is a clinical researcher in autoimmune and cholestatic liver disease. And he is the Lily and Terry Horner Chair in Autoimmune Liver Disease at Toronto General Hospital and Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology at the University of Toronto. Today, we are going to have a conversation around the best practice for managing primary biliary cholangitis now and in the future. This will include discussions around current recommendations for the diagnosis and management of PBC, an overview of the latest data on emerging and new therapies, and an assessment of processes for implementing personalised management for anybody who is living with the condition. To begin our conversation, I would just like to present a very brief overview around PBC. So PBC is a rare cholestatic disorder that affects the small bile ducts within the liver. It is characterised by elevated circulating values of an antibody, principally anti-mitochondrial antibodies, and biochemical evidence of cholestasis. Histologically, what we see is an inflammatory component wherein the small bile ducts within the liver become damaged, and untreated, this can lead to liver disease progression, cirrhosis, and associated complications. I mentioned that it's a rare condition. It predominantly affects women above the age of 50 years old. That term predominant means there are about 25% of individuals who do not fall in that bracket. We see younger individuals, we see people who of male sex who are affected with PBC that may present differently, and we will go on to talk about those later in our conversation. The first line therapy for primary biliary cholangitis is urso deoxycholic acid. It has been shown to improve liver biochemistry, slow liver disease progression, and reduce the need for liver transplantation and prolong transplant-free survival. However, about 25 to 40% of individuals exhibit an inadequate response to urso deoxycholic acid and require new and emerging therapies. At present, the only licensed second-line treatment for people with PBC is obeticholic acid. And we offer this drug to individuals who exhibit an inadequate response to urso deoxycholic acid alone or who are intolerant to urso. So as a broad overview to diagnosing and managing PBC, we have a wealth of clinical guidelines from the UK, from Europe, from North America, and the Asia Pacific region. And they centre on three core themes: the diagnosis, managing risk, and assessing response to treatment. Diagnosis, as I alluded to, centres around cholestatic biochemistry and serology. In the current contemporary clinical climate, we do not use liver biopsy as part of our diagnostic pathway. However, liver biopsy is still useful in cases where the diagnosis is in doubt. When it comes to stratifying risk, principally this revolves around patient demographics, liver biochemistry, as well as an assessment of liver disease stage in terms of fibrosis. There are many different ways of assessing response to treatment, which we will go on to talk about in our discussion. These are all focused around a wealth of data looking at people treated with urso deoxycholic acid for many years. So over to you, Professor Hirschfield. I'm just going to ask you some of the questions that were submitted by our audience. So first of all, can you talk to me about your approach? in diagnosing and staging PBC.
Well, thanks, Palak, for a great introduction to PBC. So, you know, as you said, common rare disease with lots of treatment choice and lots of opportunity to improve the outcomes for our patients' quality and quantity of life. And for me, what's always really important, therefore, is to make a very clear diagnosis at the beginning and to understand where my patient has started from. Because the goal of a hepatologist is to prevent end-stage liver disease, to prevent the need for liver transplantation, and to improve quality of life. I can do that if I have a confident diagnosis and I understand the stage and therefore my goals of treatment. So really what I first of all do is listen to the patient. I listen to their history. I listen to why they've come to my clinic. I listen to anything in their family history. I am listening to see whether they've got symptoms. I'm listening to work out why were they tested. I then look at the pattern of blood tests and confirm it's a cholestatic injury. With a cholestatic injury, I'm then going to do some autoimmune testing. And in particular, like you said, I'm going to rely on AMA testing. In the correct context, cholestasis, AMA positivity, frequently elevated IgM, I can very confidently tell my patient they have PBC. Now, there may be times where I have to think a little bit harder and I need to think about overlap with fatty liver or whether there is any secondary hepatitis that might be steroid responsive. That's in fact incredibly rare. The other issue that can be a challenge depending on your laboratory is if the patient is AMA negative, and then it depends on what access you have to good immunology testing. I will rely on GP210, SP100, anti-centromere and ANA immunofluorescence, and I will try and avoid doing a liver biopsy. However, liver biopsy may have a role and I may still do it occasionally. Of course, there'll be some imaging, but in fact, in diagnosing PBC, I'm using largely only ultrasound, and I'm resisting the temptation to do MRI. Finally, you know, you asked me about stage. This is something patients ask all the time. You know, what's really important is the diagnosis and the treatment journey and how you're going to prevent late-stage disease. At the beginning, sometimes, but not commonly, a patient presents with cirrhosis. Therefore, that will be apparent by spleen size, platelet count, and ultrasound morphology. Increasingly, we are using elastography in our practice, but I would counsel everybody that if they're going to use elastography at the beginning, is to really they need to wait for at least 6 to 12 months of treatment to really see the true measure of elastography in terms of fibrosis. Because elastography will measure cholestasis, inflammation, and fibrosis. So I tell the patient an approximate idea of what stage they are at the beginning of their journey, but I remind them I'll come back to that discussion later on. I know that the stakes are higher if my patient has a more late stage disease, but I equally know, because I spend a lot of time educating, that the majority of my patients are diagnosed with early stage disease, and therefore at a time in their disease course where I can make a real difference. Because with my clear diagnosis, which is usually elevated ALT-FOS, AMA positivity, plus or minus elevated IgM, I can initiate first-line treatment, consider second-line treatment, and discuss the future panorama for disease-modifying and symptom-controlling drugs being developed.
Thank you very much. That's very, very clear. So on to the second set of questions that our audience has submitted today. I'd just like to ask you, there are many different measures for defining treatment non-response to urso deoxycholic acid. What is your approach in determining whether somebody is a responder versus a non-responder to urso deoxycholic acid?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I look at the whole patient. And actually, something that's very important is the patient's age. So we know that the younger you present with PBC, the more likely you are to have, and I prefer the term insufficient response to urso deoxycholic acid. So age is very important to me. We then know, because of the work we did with the Global PBC Study Group, that in fact, there's a log linear association with alkaline phosphatase values and outcomes. Then we also know that you can have cutoffs. And those cutoffs will largely predict outcome, and they're also largely arbitrary. So I encourage people to use a cutoff in their practice of ALT-FOS, generally at 12 months, because that aligns with current reimbursement policies, that they are comfortable with. The original criteria that we used in Toronto was 1.67 times the upper limit of normal, and that translated into the clinical trials of obeticholic acid. 1.5 times the upper limit of normal is equally effective and has in fact the same C statistic for predicting outcome. So I think it's perfectly reasonable to look at around about 1.5 to 1.67 times the upper limit of normal as a threshold. Now, what's really important is that those cutoffs were in an era where we had limited choices. We now know that we should target normal. And therefore, you know, in my head, I am thinking to myself, okay, so this is the cutoff that will get me reimbursement or trigger current treatment choices. But I'm also thinking, okay, I can do better than that. And normal is best, normal ELF-FOS, normal bilirubin. So I encourage everyone who practices PBC to have a simple measure of risk stratification, 1.5, 1.67 times the upper limit of normal, currently at 12 months. But at the same time, to recognize that through aspiration, they really should be aiming for normal. I also encourage everyone who looks after patients with PBC to recognize if you see a patient under the age of 50, you can make a big difference as a hepatologist by treating them to normal targets. And they are then most likely not to need a liver transplant. And I am absolutely confident that I am seeing less patients being discussed at our transplant weekly meeting with PBC than I was 5 to 10 years ago.
So thank you, Gideon, for that overview. So I'd now like to ask you about non-licensed off-label treatment with fibric acid derivatives. When and how might they be used to treat people with PBC? What's your practice?
That's a great question. So yeah, I have two licensed therapies that I use regularly, and I use safely and I use effectively. But I also will use off-label therapy. Now, I work in Canada and you're based in Europe, so I have access to fenofibrate and to bezafibrate. Bezafibrate tends to be the drug that I tend to use because I see it as having a good, more favorable safety profile. So there are two times that I will use bezafibrate. One is when I do not have sufficient impact from obeticholic acid. So patient is diagnosed with PBC. They have insufficient response at 12 months. I introduce obeticholic acid, which I use effectively, and I target 10 milligrams. I have still not met my treatment goal, be that, you know, ELF-FOS of less than 1.5 or less than 1.67 times the upper limit normal. At that point, bezafibrate will be introduced. I may initiate the drug every other day. Bezafibrate is also a drug that has, because of its mechanisms on treating PBC, along with other PPARs in development, is antipruritic. Therefore, in patients with elevated ELF-FOS and pruritus with PBC, for whom I've not got sufficient pruritus control, I might also consider bezafibrate. I am not currently using bezafibrate to treat itch if someone has a normal alkaline phosphatase. I have not been convinced that the impact on pruritus is sufficient. What that means is I have patients on triple therapy who 5 years ago would have had abnormal liver tests who now have normal tests. It means that I have patients on a variety of different itch therapies, a fibrate, rifampin, gabapentin. And it means that our whole treatment of PBC has become more dynamic and more nuanced, but I believe more effective.
So the next chapter in our conversation is going to be about understanding the evolving treatment landscape in PBC. So as Professor Hirschfield alluded to, obeticholic acid is the licensed second-line treatment for people with an inadequate response or intolerance to urso deoxycholic acid. There is a wealth of data from robust randomized control clinical trials showing that people who take obeticholic acid in addition to urso deoxycholic acid experience reductions in liver biochemistry that are associated with improved transplant-free survival. And these observations have been validated by a series of real-world outcome studies where obeticholic acid has been given to treat hundreds and hundreds of individuals with validation of biochemical improvements and response to therapy. One of the challenges in using obeticholic acid, however, is that some individuals experience an exacerbation of symptoms, principally pruritus, and indeed some individuals may experience pruritus associated with their PBC for the first time. Alongside obeticholic acid and fibric acid derivatives, Professor Hirschfield alluded to the mechanism of action of the latter. Fibric acid derivatives, bezafibrate, fenofibrate, are PPAR agonists. And these are very much the first generation in that class of agent that we are using in liver medicine. However, there are newer generation PPAR agonists, elafibrinol, seladelpar, saroglitazar, which have also shown reductions in liver biochemistry when given alongside urso deoxycholic acid in individuals who are inadequate responders. So this brings us on to the second series of questions that have been submitted by our audience. So Gideon, the next generation PPAR therapies, how do they differ in their treatment targets compared to bezafibrate and fenofibrate? And assuming and hoping they are eventually approved for use in PBC, how do you envisage them fitting into the treatment paradigm for PBC?
Well, that's a really great question, Pelek. So the first thing to say is it's very exciting. We have a number of agents that are being developed specifically for PBC patients around the world. So that means we're moving into licensed therapy, which is better for everybody, because then wherever you live with PBC, you can be treated with confidence that the drug that you take was designed for and in mind of and considered for the benefits and challenges of PBC. So what we see is a variety of drugs that are being targeting different PPAR, nuclear receptor agonists, and we have elafibrinol, seladelpar, and saroglitazar. We have phase two data that across all three of those drugs demonstrate biochemical efficacy, suggest to us that they are also antipruritic, and teach us about the relative safety of each of the different drugs and the appropriate dose for phase 2b or phase 3 studies in the case of seladelpar and elafibrinol. Now, we don't yet know what those phase 3 studies will show us. We expect that they will show significant benefit for patients, but we can't yet tell anyone which drug will perform in which way until we see that data in 2023, 2024. It's clear, however, that you can get anticholestatic and anti-inflammatory effects by targeting any of these PPAR components. Now, some of the drugs obviously target more than one. So seladelpar, of course, is a delpar. It's not a fibric acid derivative. It's a delpar that is very specific around PPAR delta, and it can demonstrate very potent anticholestatic and antipruritic effects. Some of the effects of elafibrinol, which are very similar, may also actually all be through delta, because it's got a pan PPAR or an alpha delta effect. Saroglitazar, for which we don't yet have the correct dose and the correct safety profile, but future trials are identifying that, may be having differential effects through gamma. And obviously, it's only going to be through ongoing studies and long-term use that we'll work out the relative strengths of these drugs. But the way I look at it is that within a few years, our patients will have a choice of second-line treatment and or add-on third-line treatment, which doesn't give them pruritus and which does significantly improve their alkaline phosphatase as a surrogate of benefit. And if our treatment goals, which I believe they will, are going to focus on normalization of alkaline phosphatase and bilirubin, this means our patients are highly likely to have access to specific PPAR agonists that will likely achieve this. That doesn't mean to say that patients may not also continue to need a obeticholic acid. I think that's highly likely that they will, particularly for the high-risk patients. But if I were a patient living with PBC, I would say this is very exciting. There, I'm going to have a choice, and these drugs are being developed for me. They are not hand-me-downs. There's nothing wrong with hand-me-downs, but you know what we really want is the confidence for clinicians who don't see a lot of patients with PBC to choose very potent therapies for their patients and to feel comfortable doing that within the context of a drug label and a safety monitoring mechanism and clear, unbiased treatment guidelines.
Thank you. That's exceptionally clear. And it is very exciting for patients and those people who look after them. Then the next question I would just like to ask you, bridging on from that, we talked about PPAR agonists, but there are other new agents that are emerging that are of a different class. And how do you envisage some of these therapies? What are these new therapies and how do you see them fitting into your clinical practice if they are successful in the clinical trials?
So, I mean, let's first of all just reframe the question. It's a great question, Palek, don't get me wrong. But first of all, when we have other second line treatments, I may not wait 12 months to start treatment in the future. I may only wait 6 months, or I may even risk stratify at diagnosis. And there will be trials which will help me provide the evidence that I don't need to wait to demonstrate treatment insufficiency. So I think that could be a big paradigm change. We will continue to use ursodeoxycholic acid for the time being, but we may find that in the future, urso may not be the drug of choice. There may be such good potent anti-cholestatic, anti-fibrotic, anti-inflammatory therapies that we don't even need ursodeoxycholic acid. And we might move from drugs given in gram quantities to drugs given in milligram quantities. Then you identify other needs in PBC. There's a need for better symptom control, pruritus and fatigue. And there's a need to develop drugs for patients who've got fibrosis, but biochemically their disease is not as active, at least serologically. From a pruritus perspective, it's really exciting. There are IBAT inhibitors that have been approved in pediatric practice for Alagille and PFIC. And similar drugs are being developed for pruritus in PBC and other cholestatic diseases. We've just published a phase 2 study of an IBAT inhibitor, and there's ongoing phase 3 studies. So symptoms are important. Fatigue is much harder. I hope there'll be drugs for fatigue in the future, but a real challenge. And then you alluded to other opportunities around fibrosis. I don't know what the next antifibrotic therapy will be. I don't know how easy it will be to develop an antifibrotic that is not disease specific, but is fibrosis specific. People are looking at a number of different approaches, different derivatives of bile acids, inhibitors of NOX1 and NOX4, for example. It's all very early phase. We need more evidence. However, in our current practice, where we do understand risk and stage, we are better able, if we collaborate internationally, to identify those patients who should go into very carefully designed clinical trials of those agents.
Final question in this particular section submitted by our audience is that these trials that we're talking about, you know, our audience have asked, you know, they vary in how they, their mechanism of action, but they also vary in the primary outcome measure, in what they measure at the end, the endpoint, as we call them. And our audience would like to know, what do you feel, in your professional opinion, is the best or ideal endpoint for a bile acid therapy, a symptomatic therapy, an antifibrotic therapy?
Another great question, something that I've spent, you know, more than the last 10 years of my life thinking about. So I think it's clear to me that serum liver tests, alkaline phosphatase, bilirubin, and others predict outcomes in PBC and are reasonably likely, that the delta in change is reasonably likely to predict outcome. And I think it is fair to say that normal tests means better outcomes. So I think that is a good surrogate endpoint for a drug being developed that is anticholestatic. That surrogate endpoint then needs to be translated into clinical outcomes as one uses a drug in the real world. So I've just presented at ASLD, we've just published in Gastroenterology, how we're now looking at clinical endpoints for patients treated with obeticholic acid and using real-world controls to match. So we're moving from understanding ALP-FOS improvements to what happens to clinical outcomes. So I think biochemistry and then real-world data is our pathway for that particular kind of drug. I think long-term placebo-controlled studies are very hard. They are aspirational, but nearly impossible to succeed with. So that covers really the classical journey for a PBC drug. If you're then talking about symptoms, we have a very good handle on pruritus. We have less of a handle on fatigue. So for pruritus, I think we have good scales that we can measure in clinical trials. We have a sense of what is a clinically meaningful improvement in pruritus. And we have a sense for the duration of a pruritus trial to demonstrate that a drug has changed that important symptom for patients. I'm not sure we know how to do fatigue yet. Quite a complex symptom, quite interdependent on a number of other symptoms, but people are working on it. Fibrosis. Well, that's hard. Okay? So elastography is a reasonable starting point, but it's not completely validated yet. I believe that elastography does predict outcome in patients living with PBC, just as it predicts outcome in other liver diseases. I believe it's measuring more than just fibrosis, but once a patient is well treated, it is largely delivering a message about fibrosis. I believe that the addition of elastography, just as the addition of liver biopsy, adds to our risk scores, be they dichotomous or continuous. Determining what the threshold should be to demonstrate that an antifibrotic drug has been effective is hard, but is likely possible in a trial of sufficient duration, which is placebo-controlled, to say that a patient that doesn't progress, as compared to a patient on placebo who does progress, is deriving benefit, and we just need to agree what the delta needs to look like. That doesn't mean that liver biopsy will have no role in studies such as that, but it's hopeful that we'll be able to use elastography and then maybe MR elastography and then maybe serum fibrosis tests like ELF and PRO-C3 and PRO-C5. So pretty hard. It's been pretty hard to start the journey without FOSS. We're excited that we've really got the journey for pruritus moving. So there's no reason for us to believe that we couldn't do the journey for fibrosis.
Thank you very much. Now, the final chapter of our discussion today is around a very important area, personalised medicine, individualising treatment of individuals with PBC to maximise their quantity and quality of life. Now, there are many dimensions when we think about personalised care. There are obviously individual demographic specific factors, such as the age at which somebody presents, which you alluded to. We haven't yet sort of come to talk about, you know, the sex of the patient. Do women, compared to men, behave slightly differently with regards to their disease activity? We've touched upon symptomatic presentations. How does that influence our decisions to treatment? But also comorbidities like concomitant fatty liver disease, and if individuals are on other particular medications. Compliance is a big issue, and we obviously want individuals to adhere to the treatments that we advise them to take to improve their quality and quantity of life. But beyond liver biochemistry, the stage of liver fibrosis is important, but we haven't really talked yet about serology and how does serology impact disease behaviour, or what serology may mean with regards to disease behaviour. There are some individuals who may exhibit features of portal hypertension without actually having evidence of cirrhosis. And there are patient populations who don't always have elevated alkaline phosphatase values as their hallmark of disease, but instead present with elevated transaminases and indeed elevated IgG values that deviate from the classical PBC picture. So I'd like to turn to you again for the next series of questions. Very briefly, what do you feel are the current barriers or limitations to achieving those goals of personalised medicine when looking after people with PBC? Can you name a couple?
Well, great question. But look, I mean, PBC is always going to be common rare. So that means patients live everywhere with PBC. So sometimes a current barrier is just getting an efficient diagnosis. If we understood what caused PBC, that would help. I think it's unlikely we'll find a magic bullet and suddenly say it's caused by X, Y, or Z. But certainly with more therapies, I think we have upped our game for making a clear diagnosis wherever somebody lives. Then we have to work very hard to make sure that everyone in our community, GIs, hepatologists, primary care patients, know that there is new and emerging treatments for PBC. Finally, we need to remind people it took us decades to prove that ursodeoxycholic acid was an effective intervention for PBC. But now we have urso and it's made a difference to our patients. It will be equally hard to prove the effects of obeticholic acid, bezafibrate, current drugs in clinical trials, on hard clinical outcomes. We are genuinely using surrogate endpoints for genuine benefit for patients. We genuinely believe that we need to have a mixture of placebo-controlled and real-world data to demonstrate true benefit beyond the surrogate. That will not be easy. We will need patients to take part in trials. We will need patients to take part in registry studies, be they studies in the UK, Europe, Canada, the US, anywhere in the world, in fact. And so we need the support of patients for research. And finally, we never want to forget the very difficult patient groups. There are no such things as difficult patients. There are patients who have difficulties. It is very hard if you've got very late stage disease. Your treatment choices are quite limited. Access to transplant is not always as clear cut as it should be. Allocation for transplant is quite a complex topic. Patients living with PBC may not be deriving the same benefit from an allocation system based on pure disease severity scores. So we need to continue to advocate to make that a more equitable system as well. So there's lots of moving parts, but what I found is that with the excitement of new drugs and the licensing of new drugs, there's a real will between people living with PBC, clinicians, be they specialists or generalists, industry, regulators, and patient support groups to all work together to really overcome some of these limitations.
What are some of the thoughts that you have regarding personalizing medicine along those themes? And what are your recommendations for optimizing or individualizing care for individuals with PBC?
Oh, that's a great question. And of course, it's not just about PBC. It's about looking after all autoimmune liver disease patients. It's about looking after all liver disease patients. So try and know your patient. Try and understand where they're coming from and try and understand the challenges that they face both in their disease and in the symptoms of that disease and in their personal life. And empower them to understand why they've got the disease and what it means for them to have treatment. You can do that as an individual clinician. You can enroll the support of patient support groups. You can use your hospital resources. So my patients have access to all of their blood results. The same time as I see the result, they see the result. My patients can message me. I can message them back. Some patients use apps. Some patients still want to just come and talk to you in clinic. Empower your patient to get the balance of in-person and virtual healthcare. So I'm alternating virtual and in-person. I tell my patient what my treatment goal is at the outset. I tell them, you know, what the likelihood of success is. I explain what their ALKFOS is and where I think I can get it. And I explain to them why I'm setting the standard that I am. I may have a different standard for someone who's 80 to a different standard for someone who's 40. I listen to the severity of their symptoms. If I cannot help their fatigue, that does not mean I will not listen to them about the fatigue, give them suggestions, and explain the limits of what I can do and what they can do. When it comes to itch, I'll explain what is achievable, what will be aspirational, and maybe what baseline symptom complex of itch they'll have to accept. And then, of course, you know, I explain to them ambulatory care. So for the majority of PBC patients, I'm seeing them every 6 to 12 months. I'm explaining why they need lifelong care. I'm explaining why they need lifelong therapy. And I'm reminding them that I will reassess in a number of ways. I'll listen to their history. I may examine them. I'll look at their blood tests. They may need a periodic ultrasound. I may get a periodic FibroScan. I'll put all of that together and decide whether the treatment goal that I set at last review remains my treatment goal or whether I need to adjust my pathway. And so I hope that if we have a process where there are clinics such as my own, where we are doing a lot of education, where we are championing guidelines, risk-based therapies, new therapies, clinical trials, use of existing therapies, that the vast majority of patients can have a future with PBC that is better, more likely to lead to a better treatment, normal tests, and better symptom control. And what that means by default is that they are getting individualized care. They are getting personalized care, and you don't have to have an ultra-rare genetic disease to get personalized care. Any disease, including a chronic disease like PBC, can benefit from personalized care. And I hope that, therefore, all of that collectively will optimize our patients' experience and outcomes.
Thank you very much. So with that, I'm actually going to ask you for some input onto a case, if I may, just to finish off our discussion. So I have an individual, you know, gentleman who has PBC and he has high risk features. He has a fibro score that is 12. He is not a biochemical responder to ursodeoxycholic acid. I started obeticholic acid, a second line therapy for his ursa non-response, but he's experiencing symptoms. He's experiencing very likely some side effects from it. he is somebody who I would like to improve the quality and quantity of their life. What is your approach to such an individual?
So the first thing is I'll tell the patient it's real, that the potential benefit from treatment is real, and his symptom complex is real, and the impact on him is impacting me, and it's making me want to do things better. So I'll tell him that he's going to derive benefit from a better cholic acid if I can sustain the treatment. But I'll also tell him it's true that it may be exacerbating some of his itch. I'll look to treat that itch. I may be able to add in bezafibrate, for example. That may be a good treatment choice for him to be on triple therapy. Ursodeoxycholic acid, obeticholic acid targeting 10 milligrams, and bezafibrate targeting 400 milligrams. And I'll tell him, I think I can improve your quality of life, I can improve your pruritus, and still improve your alkaline phosphatase. I'll be honest and tell him, fatigue is a very, very complex symptom. It is very debilitating. It's made worse by itch. It's made worse by social isolation. I'll tell him my choices for fatigue are harder. But if I get the itch better, I think the fatigue will get better. If that's not sufficient, having excluded alternative causes of fatigue, hypothyroidism, beta blockers, sleep apnea, dysautonomia, I'll tell him that we'll work on some simple strategies. Exercise. Exercise is really, really important. It's hard. Fatigue is more than just tiredness. It's an inability to complete tasks. It's brain fog. It is a battery that runs down too quickly. But exercise, improving muscle power, improving the signals going back to your brain can help. There may even be occasions when I would treat the fatigue with drugs like modafinil. It's pretty unusual that I'll do that. But if I am giving my patient a clear knowledge base so that he feels empowered to understand his disease, and he recognizes that I am tackling a disease severity, treatment side effects, pruritus with drugs like bezafibrate, rifampin, gabapentin, and fatigue with a holistic approach, then I genuinely believe I will make a difference. I can't tell you, Palak, that I will stop this man from having a transplant. I can tell you that I genuinely believe I will delay the day that he needs a transplant. And I genuinely believe that that is better. And I can also tell the patient that his treatment choices may look completely different in 2024, 25, and 26. So working hard now is worth it, and it's never the time to give up on that holistic approach to care.
Thank you very much. Wise words. So with that, I would like to thank my colleague, Professor Hirschfield, for a very enthralling conversation around several important elements in managing PBC. And I would like to thank you, the audience, for your attention. And I wish you a very good day.
Thank you to both our faculty, and thank you for listening to this Touch podcast. You can access more content on primary biliary cholangitis on Touch Immunology at www.touchimmunology.com.